I'm delighted to be here tonight in the cozy confines of Artifact Coffee to continue our Origin Speaker Series. I'm Spike Jurta, the owner of Woodbury Kitchen here in Baltimore. This gathering is intended to advance the conversation about food, its origins, and what is happening around our food system in the Chesapeake Bay watershed. We started our first restaurant, Woodbury Kitchen, with a commitment to local sourcing, and now work closely with more than 60 different farmers and producers throughout the region. We supply our four restaurants and our canning and butchery operations with meat, eggs, grains, fish and shellfish, cooking oil, cheeses and produce, literally everything we need to feed our guests. The hope is that this series will shine a light on the work that this community is doing in our area. The conversation is held monthly at Artifact, our coffee shop, in the heart of the Woodbury neighborhood in Baltimore. Okay, tonight on Origins, we have a really interesting conversation about chicken farming in our region with three guys who really know which came first. I'd like to welcome Andrew McLean, an agricultural lender for more than 20 years. He started his wholesale poultry operation on the eastern shore of Maryland 10 years ago. Andrew recently converted his chicken operation from conventional to organic and now sells over 900,000 birds annually to Coleman, a division of Purdue. Andrew was past president of the Delmarva Poultry Industry Board of Directors and still currently serves on their board. Here's Bo Ramsburg. Bo owns Rhettland Farms with his wife Kat and operates it with their four children and a team of four dedicated staff. Bo started Rhettland in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in 2007 and produces pastured chickens and heritage breed pork for direct sale to places like Parts and Labor and home cooks all over the area. Rhettland Farm was recently certified by the USDA to process the farm's chicken under inspection by that agency. We'll hear about the benefits of adding processing to Bo's operation at Rhettland. Finally, we have Will Morrow. Will owns and operates Whitmore Farm, a diversified pasture-based livestock farm raising pigs, sheep, and chickens. Located in Emmitsburg, Maryland, Whitmore Farm emphasizes sustainability and specializes in heritage breed livestock. Will's goods are currently sold at area farmers markets and direct off the farm, as well as select local restaurants including Tail Up Goat, Volt, The Dabney, and our two restaurants, Parts and Labor and Woodbury Kitchen. And now, here's Dana Slater.
So I'm Dana Slater, the producer of the Origin Speaker Series, and I'm delighted to say this is our 12th episode, and I can't even believe that we didn't do chicken, like as one of the first few, but here we are, doing chicken and eggs, a kind of a staple in everybody's diet, and here in Maryland, it's huge. I just wanted to read a couple of little facts that I found today, just doing a little research for tonight, about the Delmarva poultry industry. Approximately 35% of Maryland's cash farm income was from meat chickens. This is from 2014, from the Delmarva poultry industry statistics. Maryland ranks 10th among the states in the pounds of meat chicken produced in 2014, with 1,554,100,000 pounds of meat produced. So it's a lot of chicken. According to the U.S. Poultry and Egg Association and the National Chicken Council, on the Delmarva Peninsula, the total economic activity of the chicken industry was estimated to be in excess of $5.6 billion in 2014. So just a few kind of economic numbers for us to get our head around, sort of to lay this whole thing out. And a couple of quick little fun facts. Chickens are omnivores. Just wanted to get that out there. They'll eat seeds and insects, but also larger prey like small mice and lizards. So we'll get into that more when we talk about their diets. With 25 billion chickens in the world, there are more of them than any other bird species. I thought this was kind of fun. The chicken was the first bird to have its genome sequenced in 2014. So who knew? So I'm just going to say one last thing, and I'm going to let you guys answer it as the night goes on. So which did come first, the chicken or the egg? I'm going to leave it at that. Turn it over to you, Spike.
Wow, thank you, Dana. And I agree with Dana. This night, I think, is long overdue. I don't think there are very many, and especially of all the topics that we've covered here, none that I can think of kind of contain so many of the questions that we're asking about our food system right now, and you know, around cost and environmental impacts and keeping farmers on their land. It all seems to kind of come down, a lot of it, to what you guys do, growing poultry and other things. So before we get into some of that, though, I'd really love, because we have such an amazing panel, to hear a little bit about your farms, your operations, what you do and what you produce, and whatever else you'd like to say about it. So let's start with Bo.
Okay.
And well, where are you in the world? I know. I mean, I know where you are, but I'd love to, right. Just hear about Rutland.
Yeah. So we're from Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. My wife and I both grew up there, not far from each other. I grew up on a dairy farm, similar to Andrew. I knew I liked him when I walked in and met him for the first time. And so meat has kind of been a sideline. Started out as a sideline for me, and then very quickly became the main line. I'm no longer in the dairy business, although my family farm is still in operation. So we kind of started. I tell people that I have a degree in dairy science from Penn State, and the two animals that I did not study were pigs and chickens, and so those are the things that we're doing now. So it's definitely been on the job training, and we've learned a lot. Pretty much just by doing. There's not a whole lot of information out there for what we're doing. People raising birds outside, raising pigs outside is kind of contradictory to the industry, that exists commercially. So along the way, it was necessary to become meat packers as well. And so we've gone down that road and have built a USDA processing plant, which is, I think, kind of neat and kind of unique. And, people have said that we couldn't do it, and we did it. Mm-hmm. And I think it's working, and it's kind of fun proving the naysayers wrong.
Always.
So and that's where we are in a nutshell.
So it's chickens, pasture chickens?
Pasture chickens, pastured heritage breed pigs. We do raise some lamb, and that's something we'd like to do more of, actually. Those are our three main products. We do a little bit of eggs as well. We have a small retail store on the farm, and so the eggs are just kind of to support that for now.
And how many acres you on up there?
We have two farms. The total of those is about 42 acres, and then we rent an additional 40 acres that we use basically for cropland and hay. So we're about an 85-acre enterprise.
And what's your production now around chickens?
Honestly, I don't know. My guess is somewhere around 10,000 birds a year. It's kind of the goal that we set for this year. The USDA process put a ding in our business. Uh-huh. We spent 2 years in that process, and yep. We lost a lot of customers that we had to go and get back. And so my goal for this year was 10,000 birds, and I think we'll probably meet that goal. As far as hogs, we're probably selling about 300 pigs a year, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Great, thanks. Switch now to the Eastern Shore. Andrew, thanks for coming up. Really appreciate you being here. I know these two guys pretty well, but we've just met, and I'm really, really interested to hear what you do. Talk about your farm, Relief Farm.
Okay. I have 6 poultry houses. They each hold 30,000 chickens. I was a conventional chicken grower for Purdue, and then switched over to Coleman Organic in January. The differences between how we grow chickens with the organic versus conventional is organic chickens have to have several things. One is entertainment centers in the chicken house.
Andrew, could you speak up a little bit?
Sure. Entertainment centers in the chicken house. And that basically is ramps and boxes for them to jump around and get in and out of. And
that's part of the organic standard.
Okay. I'm certified by everybody. We have GAP certification, organic certification. Of course, MDE comes out and MDA comes out. Uh-huh. So I'm always got somebody out there. And then they have to be out on pasture. So I was showing a few people here tonight a picture. When I open the doors in the morning, it's like you're pouring chickens out the door. They all race for the door to go outside. Now, they'll go back in later on in the day. And, of course, the main thing is you have to feed them organic grain, and you can't ever give them any antibiotics or anything else. So if they get sick, they get oregano.
Seriously.
It smells like pre-seasoned chickens inside the house. And I do know why the chicken crossed the road.
Okay.
To prove to the possum it could be done.
Gotcha.
But basically, so that's what I do. I raise chickens. My day is spent probably 4 or 5 hours actually going through the chicken houses, making sure everything's working properly, making sure they're doing everything, you know, everything's healthy. And then the rest of the day is being a mechanic, troubleshooting, because I have 126 electric motors and miles of piping and, you know, so any 8 computers. So anything that can go wrong does go wrong.
So you got, you said it's 30,000 birds in 6 houses.
30,000 birds a house.
House. So, and what is that?
It's 180,000 birds.
Sure. And so your production annually is?
I don't know. That depends. I do five and a half flocks a year, roughly.
Okay.
So.
Somebody quicker with the math.
But, you know, that's the business on the Eastern Shore. I mean, we're in the poultry business, and that's what we do down there. And the reason, part of the reason that I switched is the closest processing plant to me is the Milford plant, and they do the organic. And then the closest feed mill is Herlock, and they do the organic feed in Herlock.
Hmm. No, that's great. I can't wait to hear more. And one of the things I love about this conversation, this panel, is that we've got such an amazing range of production practices, scale, everything. So let's hear from Will here, and then we'll get into some of the more.
Hi, my name is Will Morrow, and I own Whitmore Farm with my husband, Kent, who could not be here tonight. It is a 30-acre farm about an hour and 15 minutes west of here in Frederick County, Maryland, and we raise pastured poultry for egg production. We generate about 75,000 eggs a year, which sounds like a lot, but it's really not. It couldn't even meet Spike's needs
Never enough.
Yeah. I did not come from a farming background. So when we bought the farm 13 years ago, I just really immersed myself in, you know, the current thinking in agriculture and read a lot of books and joined Future Harvest, Chesapeake Alliance for Sustainable Agriculture, which was really huge to help us network and meet other farmers like myself. And it was kind of reassuring actually to be at these conferences and meet so many people that had other careers and financing or whatever and have later in life returned to farming. And so it was validating as well. And it has been a steep learning curve. And it's been 13 years now. We have tweaked the business model over the years, emphasizing one species over another. It's a diversified farm. It always has been, where we raise multiple species. Right now we raise pigs, chickens for egg production, and sheep. In the past we've had a rabbit operation. We've had goat operation. You know, it's not unlike many small businesses. You have to test different enterprises to try to be financially successful. And so we've experimented with different models, and what's worked best for us has been the pastured pork production and the egg production with our pastured hens as well. And then we still have a flock of sheep that used to be, lamb used to be a big part of what we do, but now it's a small part of what we do because we just couldn't make the numbers work. We've also experimented with organic certification, not in our egg production, but in our lamb and goat. And there's lots of interesting things to talk about organic productions and its implications. So I'm happy to be here tonight.
Whatever happened to the rabbits? That was the one thing. We got some great rabbit from you early on.
Yeah, you know, rabbits are profitable. I will give you that. But you just need a lot of rabbits.
All right, so I want to talk for a second about the why. I think each of you guys have an interesting and, you know, specific way you do things. And what I've come to learn, you know, being at Woodbury now for almost 9 years, is like you've got to understand why you're doing it, or you just eventually you're going to throw up your hands and give up. And I guess, Andrew, I'd like to start with you because you're a guy that came from another profession, right, from the finance world, and you made a choice, conscious decision to go into chicken farming. And I'd like to pose that question to you, like, why did you move from the banking world into chicken production?
Banking's not really a hard job to give up these days. part of it was the banking world has changed. And so, you know, before where I had lending authority and could do things and make decisions, in the current banking world, I had to ask permission to, you know, blow my nose. So that was part of it, is I really wanted to get out of banking. Poultry is what we do on the Eastern Shore, and I have 350 acres, which I rent out. That's not enough land to do a grain farming operation.
Uh-huh.
We're not close enough to major markets to do a lot of, you know, fresh market type growing. So, you know, poultry was almost a default to get into. And it was something that I could get into without having and create cash flow instantly. And you know, I look at everything through my back wallet, I mean, my back pocket.
Well, and it's funny you should bring that up because I've read a lot about the fact that, you know, and it seems like a lot of chicken farmers, the larger scale ones in the industry, have a hard time making it sometimes economically. But you had a background in finance and you were able to, I mean, it made sense to you.
It's not really that difficult to make it if you make good business decisions.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, my newest project is I'm looking at getting solar. Because that's something that I can do that isn't going to take a lot more time, but it will return later on. So I'm always trying to think of that next thing. And, you know, one of the things, I don't ever want to be the innovator. I want to be the early adopter.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm always, and that's kind of why I got into the organic was, you know, other people were the innovators. I want to be the early adopter and make some money that way.
Gotcha. But why do you do it the way that you do it? Pastured animals, I mean, and now the processing on the farm?
Yeah, I think that one thing just kind of led to another. So uh-huh. We started, you know, like I said, we started with pigs, and I started with frustration with the dairy industry,
okay,
to be honest. And, you know, there was a frustration that the dairy industry, especially the conventional dairy industry, is incredibly complex, and there's not a whole lot of rhyme or reason to why you get paid what you get paid, but the bottom line is most of the time it's not enough. And I didn't like that lack of control. I felt like I wanted to either succeed or fail, but I wanted to do it in a game that I understood the rules. So there was a lot of frustration there. With that industry, and so we picked up pigs just kind of, I say that it was just to raise for ourselves, but I think maybe in the back of my mind I kind of was looking for, you know, for something a little different, and knew that pork was something that we could market. You know, initially I didn't have designs on a wholesale market. You know, we were just going to raise some pigs for people to put in their freezer. That took a spin. You know, we had our first restaurant customer bought all the pigs that we had at one time, and then the same guy, you know, 4 months later said, hey, would you be willing to grow us some chickens? You know, we can't find a chicken that we're happy with. And so I said sure, and he was blown away by him.
This
and
was Andrew Little?
It was Andy Little at Shepherd Mansion.
So. Yeah.
So, you know, I guess we would credit him with the encouragement, you know, giving me the confidence that we had a market for it, and then encouraging us to keep going. And so that's how we got started. And then everything else has just kind of gone from there. You know, Woodbury picked us up in 2011.
I remember driving up there with George.
Yeah,
I still remember it.
And
yeah.
We, you know, you guys saw our processing plant that you know, in its infancy.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, since then it's become, you know, it's the really cool thing is that our customers share the same values that we do. Like we try to do things environmentally consciously, and we try to factor in the human element to, you know, the people that work for us and the people that we're growing food for. And and the really cool thing is the people that we're selling to value the same things. And so I think a lot of it is I would say is customer driven, but the really cool thing is what it's the direction that we want to go.
Right.
We're not being dragged in a direction we don't want to go.
Right. Well, I think the visit that we took way back when to Whitmore Farm, and I think you know, for me, and I think a lot of the folks from Woodbury that were with me, it was one of the first times I'd heard somebody in your position, you and Kent, both telling us things that helped us understand what we were trying to do at Woodbury. It was an incredible moment. And so I'm really interested to hear from you, because you have such a cool perspective on it. You know, what is it that drives you to get up every morning and make Whitmore, keep Whitmore?
No pressure there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I came to the farming from a consumer perspective, not unlike I'm sure many people in the audience here tonight, where I was shopping at the farmers, best farmers markets. I was living downtown in D.C., and so I would seek out the best farmers markets. I would go to restaurants that sourced locally, and I really valued those things and appreciated them. My day job for 15 years in D.C. was in environmental policy work, and I know very well how agriculture is responsible for a very significant portion of the water pollution that you see in the Chesapeake Bay and throughout the country. And I somehow wanted to kind of like marry those, you know, my concern for the environment as well as my value and love of good food that's raised well, and who doesn't like animals? So animal welfare is was important to me as well. Some things had happened in my career that provided an opportunity for me to do something that else that I wanted. And so I was like, you know, why not? Let me try this. There's no time better than the present. And so it was a little scary, but at the same time, I like a challenge. And a lot of people that I spoke to, you know, said it couldn't be done. You know, these are conventional commodity growers, corn, soybean. You can't make any money unless you have 1,000 acres, you know. And I'm a little pig-headed, and if someone tells me, throws down the gauntlet and says something can't be done, I'm the one that tends to want to try to prove them wrong. So I kind of like fell into it that way, and, mm-hmm. and I will say it's been the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, and it's also been, I've never made less money in my entire life. it has a different set of rewards.
Yeah. There's something cool going on here. Interesting, I guess. First, I want to understand the difference between chicken and egg production. Kind of to Dana's question, why aren't there more eggs produced on the? Do you have a sense of why there aren't more eggs produced on the Eastern Shore, where there is a huge concentration of chicken production? It seems like they're separate things.
It is.
Okay.
From a commercial standpoint, it's a totally separate business.
Why is that? I mean, not why are they separate, but why would the Eastern Shore be such a great place for chicken production, but not such a... Or maybe, Will, you have some sense of this, because you're doing eggs.
You know, I don't, other than knowing that there's a whole economy of scale, and I would think that when you've got broiler growers congregating in a certain couple counties or whatever, there you have the efficiencies of using the same feed mill and the same... processors.
Uh-huh.
Where so I'd imagine the same kind of efficiencies would apply to egg production, which is just a different set of companies. I believe that Pennsylvania has a much stronger shell egg production network than Maryland does. I know, for example, when we were looking into organic egg production for our farm, one of the reasons why we didn't go that route was we had to import the organic feed from out of state, and we, in the end, felt that it had a higher carbon footprint than if we supported the local grain growers in our county and supported our local feed mill.
Right,
so
right.
I think how whenever a business starts, like an either boiler production company, Purdue, or an egg company, they're going to kind of grow in that region and expand out from there.
And so there it is. But, and so the other point that you've led us into is this question of you're organic, certified organic, along with the other certifications, right? And you guys, neither of you are.
No.
And to me, that there's an interesting kind of wrinkle there. You're the biggest producer at the table, and you've got the organic certification. You guys are very thoughtful and producers, but you're not. And I guess there's two questions maybe there. Why not? And why was it? You kind of hinted at it earlier, but I'd like to hear more about your transition to organic.
Well, the transition was altering the chicken houses, and
more also, about the why do it, why go for it?
Because I wanted a new challenge.
Everybody at this table seems to share that little.
I got
to
keep my mind active.
Yeah, common thread there.
And you know, looking towards that new challenge, and if this is what customers want, then I want to be on that cutting edge of delivering what people want.
And there's a market, you recognize the market opportunity. Is that fair? Or? that you saw the demand coming?
I mean, I saw the demand coming, and I know, you know, going to various meetings that people are more interested in their food production nowadays than what they were 20 years ago.
Sure.
And so I wanted to be there to offer that.
And you guys, conversely, have considered it, but both have, I mean, Will just talked about one of the reasons, or maybe the reason he didn't.
Yeah, I mean, I would love to. I would love to be certified. I think Will touched on one of the main reasons, and that's in order to be. So a classic example is, which I tell people is, to be organic chicken feed usually has some kind of fish meal in it. And for me, this was a deal breaker. So what they do is because of the need to naturally supplement amino acids, in the case of chickens, it's lysine. In the case of meat chickens, it's lysine. They have to find a natural source. The most viable natural source is fish meal. For producers our size, what that means is they catch fish in the Gulf of Mexico explicitly for this purpose. This isn't bycatch. It's not, you know, it's not processing plant waste. They catch just for this purpose. They grind them up. They put them in a bag. They put them on a truck, and they ship them to Gettysburg, Pennsylvania. And to me, that seemed like going the wrong direction. Like, we were, yes, it was organic, but it felt like that was the lesser of the two evils that we were faced. On top of that, you know, I think all of us we still have to produce a product that people can afford and want to afford. And for producers, at least our size, my size, you know, our chickens are sold at a premium price. And to gain that organic certification and to buy that expensive feed that we had to have shipped across the country added an additional cost that I didn't feel like the market would bear. So for us, it's purely an economic thing. If we could find a way that we could do it and maintain, you know, the price point that we're at, I would do it tomorrow.
I think another difference, though, is that Bo and I sell directly to either chefs or consumers, where I believe you're selling to wholesale to a company. And I think I know that when we were talking to a grocery store about stocking our eggs, things like all these certifications that you mentioned really mattered to them, so that they can get the price point that they wanted to get. Whereas I'm doing 3 farmers markets a week. You know, my customers know me. You know, Chef Spike and other restaurants we sell to have all been out to our farm, so they've seen our operation. So though, when you have face-to-face transactions like that, you build a relationship, and they don't care so much about these third-party certifications. Where if I'm selling to a company, they care very much about those third-party certifications.
Right. We have the opportunity to explain, just like I just explained to you, you know, face-to-face interaction of why we don't do that. And folks that are growing at the scale that Andrew is, the only way they had to communicate that is on the label.
Right.
And so that's a step that they have to take in order to be able to communicate that and differentiate themselves from anybody else.
And so we're clear, Andrew, your chickens are now sold under the Coleman label, is that right?
Yeah, they're sold under the Coleman label. I think locally, like Whole Foods, Trader Joe's, a few other stores like that, and then some restaurants that are offering it.
And Coleman is the company, the organic company that was purchased by Purdue.
Correct.
Relatively recently, right?
Or 3-4 years ago.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And this is all part of, I think, it seems like Purdue has made the same kind of judgment about where the market's going. They've made several, I think, moves lately to reduce. I remember the arsenic. They were the first, mm-hmm. I think, to eliminate arsenic in their feed. Obviously moving, I think, towards, they've also committed to no antibiotics. Is that correct?
Yeah, they've committed to the no antibiotics. And in fact, a lot of the things that we are doing on the organic side, they're transferring over to the conventional chicken side. But, you know, Purdue, they're different marketplaces. Purdue is a branded product, and so they're trying to make the most out of, you know, having a branded product, whereas some other companies on the Eastern Shore are selling to restaurants and to, if you will, the wholesale market. And so they aren't doing quite as much in that regard.
Right. So I guess one of the things I wanted to talk about, and, you know, we've got this range, we've talked a little bit about eggs, and we've got a guy here who is, you know, by any measures is a fairly scaled up producer, right? But it seems like the industry is going even further down that road. And I think one of the things that concerns me, I've read a lot about farming the way that you do it. I'm encouraged by a lot of this, I think the progress that's being made around production chicken farming, but then I'm hearing about these mega chicken houses that are getting built down there, and that they're getting built on smaller and smaller or proportionally smaller parcels of land. Do you have any perspective on that?
Well, I do.
I mean, and I think some of these guys, I mean, to take it a little further, some of them are you know, relocating to the Eastern Shore. They're not, you know, a lot of what we know about the Eastern Shore farming is that it's generational, and there are growers that have been there for many years, some newcomers like you, but there are people that are entirely new to that part of the country that are landing and building up. I mean, what actually makes your operation seem kind of small?
Well, and my operation is the size it is on purpose. I'm not going to expand because this is what I can take care of myself. I don't have to have any hired help. This is what I do. It's my full-time job.
Right.
And, you know, we had backyard chickens for a while, a long time ago. And I asked my wife the other day, do you know for certain that they always had fresh water every day or they always had feed every day? No. For my chickens, if they're out of feed for 2 hours, it's a catastrophe for me.
Uh-huh.
A catastrophe for them is one of the 24 water lines in the chicken house isn't working. So that's my full-time. It's got all my attention. There are bigger farms being built. Generally, they're on bigger parcels of land now because of the setbacks that are required. But the business model is changing. Mm-hmm. And right in my phone, in fact, I checked it when I first pulled up here, I can pull up my computer that sees all six chicken houses. I can make adjustments to it. That kind of economies of scale allows one person to manage quite a few chicken houses. All you have to do is add labor and, of course, the capital to build them,
mm-hmm.
and you can manage it. So that's why the scalability is going up.
Right. I guess my concern would be not that aspect of it, but some of the other things that I think are pretty well known, and I'm encouraged by someone who's thoughtful and cares like you clearly do. But, you know, I think as these things scale, it's hard to escape, you know, some of the consequences that come along with it around, you know, the elephant in the room a lot of times is waste, right? Is chicken mm-hmm. litter, is that the... and it seems like these bigger, I think they're calling them mega farms, are just going to concentrate or exacerbate some of those issues. And this comes right back to the, you know, for me, which is always at the center of this conversation, which is Chesapeake Bay water quality. And it seems troubling to me. I don't know if I'm...
Well, I had a dairy background.
Uh-huh.
And I can tell you the best environmentally controlled dairy farm on the Eastern Shore, because I've been on all of them, I think,
uh-huh.
is also the largest. Because they have the capital and the manpower to make sure that everything is done correctly. I'm less concerned, really, about the large poultry farms doing things correctly than I am about the one or two and two house poultry farms mm-hmm. that nobody's really watching. We have a challenge ahead of us, and certainly on the lower shore, they do have a challenge with poultry litter. But as far as can we use it, there's more than enough ground on Delmarva to utilize every bit of litter. We still buy and use millions and millions of pounds of commercial inorganic nitrogen that is all new nutrients to the watershed. So if you use poultry litter instead of inorganic fertilizer, you are recycling the nutrients.
Right. I guess, I mean, the issues, and I don't want you, I'm not putting you on the spot, and you know, to represent the entire poultry industry of the... But this is something that I've been thinking about for a long time. It's one of the things I think that keeps us thinking about, you know, where our chickens are coming from and who we're buying them from at Woodbury Kitchen. And, you know, part of it's phosphorus going into the bay. I think the poultry litter is, you know, clearly it seems like the phosphorus-nitrogen relationship is out of whack and we're ending up with a lot of phosphorus. We've got issues in the bay. I'm still nervous or anxious about...
We do have challenges with that, but
right.
I can tell you that 15 years ago, you know what the recommendation from the University of Maryland was? No more than 15 tons to the acre of poultry litter should be applied.
Uh-huh.
That was from the University of Maryland. Now we're down to using 2 to 3 tons every other year. So we've come way down. We're just starting to really understand how phosphorus moves through the watershed.
Right, right. Well, there was I think there was a thought that it didn't at one point.
Exactly.
Right.
And so what we're paying for now in that regard is we're paying for the sins of the father, if you will. And the phosphorus that's actually entering the bay from agriculture is coming from, what do they call it?
Legacy.
There we go.
Gotcha.
I mean, it does bring up a good point, though, about the imbalance in using animal manure as your sole source of fertility. And we've run into this in our farm because we don't buy inorganic fertilizers. And so the problem with poultry litter and chicken manure in general is that it's higher in phosphorus than it is than nitrogen. So when you apply it to your crops for fertilizer, you're still short nitrogen. And so since most farmers have this big pile of manure just sitting right behind the barn there, they just add more manure to that same field to try to get the nitrogen on it because that's what they want, but they're also bringing with it the excess phosphorus. And so that same decision making over decades and decades results in these saturated soils. So for example, so for us, I know that my fields are on average about 30% less productive. We have perennial pasture throughout the entire 30 acres, but that's food for me because that's what the sheep convert to lamb, which we sell to Spike and other people. So it is a crop to me. And I pay attention to what my yield of forage is per acre. And I would get about 30% more forage per acre if I supplemented with the synthetic nitrogen, but we made a decision not to do it for that reason. But I think I have a problem with the monoculture that I see coming up on the Eastern Shore, and because I think if you just have too much of one thing in one geographic region, then it just sets nature off balance. And I've seen that on my own farm when we use our manure for fertilizer and we realize we have to stop because we've reached the phosphorus level, and even though I'm short on nitrogen, unless I bought blood meal or some other organic form of nitrogen, I'm just going to have to live with lower production. And unfortunately, when you talk about corporations, they're not willing to live with lower production for anything.
Gotcha. Well, we've got an amazing packed house, and I'd love to, this conversation always is at its best when everybody's involved, so let's
I have an egg problem. So when I go to the store, you know, back in the day, there were like three choices of eggs. There were medium eggs and large eggs and extra large eggs, and I picked the size I wanted and I was done. And now there are like just 6, 7, 8 kinds of eggs. They're cage-free eggs, they're organic eggs, they're large eggs and small eggs. And I look at that and I have no idea how to make a decision.
Yeah, I don't blame you. It's hard. No, the labeling is out of control. It really is.
There are too many choices.
There are too many choices. It's called the specialty egg market. The specialty egg market has exploded. The specialty egg is pretty much everything other than your plain old egg. So some poultry farms will supplement their chicken feed with a very high concentration of flax seed, which results in high omega-3 concentrations in the yolks. And so now they can advertise their eggs for that, for people who care about that. Another farm or egg company may add lutein to their eggs, which results in more yellow yolks, and it also has been proven to help with macular degeneration. So then they advertise their eggs as being high in lutein. You know, and then there are, as you said, at least 10 different options that way.
So are those claims, those label claims, certifications, or are they just, like, are they, if, you know, clearly if Andrew says I'm organic certified, that's, who is your certifier?
It's through the USDA.
So he's got an organic certification, but these, I agree, these profusion of labels, and are they certified by anyone, or are they just like?
I don't think that most of them are.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So what does it say on your egg? Oh, you don't do...
No, we do retail eggs as well, yeah.
So what does it say on your egg carton?
Grade AA, large. our eggs are they look very different, and so they're in a clear plastic container so that you know, you can just see that they're different. I don't have any of those advertisement type things on there. We chose to specialize in heritage breeds from a breed conservation, breed preservation standpoint, because one of the other side effects of the industrialization of agriculture is they've chosen one or two select breeds, and then boom, that white leghorn is 95% of the poultry population for the egg producers in this country. The Holstein cow for milk. And so a lot of these breeds that don't have a job then can go extinct, and we wanted to maintain that. So anyhow, we selected chicken breeds that lay very unusual colored eggs, very pretty shells, blue shells, green shells, dark brown shells, spotted shells. And the shell does not convey anything different as far as flavor or nutritional content, but people like pretty things, and what we found is they were willing to pay for pretty things. Now, we did go the extra mile to invest a lot, do a lot of research, and work with a poultry nutritionalist to come up with a custom feed formula to also have superior interior egg quality as well, so that people like Spike, who wouldn't be fooled by a pretty eggshell, would still like our eggs because of the interior content, which has a lot of premium attributes to it as well.
Andrew, can you tell us about the Delmarva Land and Litter Challenge?
The Delmarva Land and Litter Challenge is a group of environmentalists, farmers, primarily poultry farmers, some grain farmers, some government people, and university folks. And we have been meeting for the last 2 years to work on basically what it says, the litter challenge that we have on Delmarva. What we're working on right now is a mass balance program to figure out where we really are, because we don't know. Nobody really knows if we're out of whack or not out of whack with how many nutrients are produced. And so that's what we're trying to find out first. And secondly is working on common sizing, because we have three different states on Delmarva, getting one poultry litter transport program for all three states so that grain farmers can utilize it much more easily. And then we're also working on are there alternative uses for poultry litter?
We hadn't, your answer to the question really interested me, because it hadn't come up, like, about breeds. Like, how many breeds are indigenous to this area, and do all chicken farmers want to preserve them?
Small farmers need to differentiate themselves in the marketplace because, one, they have to command a premium for their product if there's any chance of their business succeeding financially. And it doesn't matter how laudable your goals and philosophy and mission is, if you're going to go out of business in 6 to 9 months, you know, it doesn't matter. So one way to differentiate yourself is to have a grow a different product. And so there is a lot of interest in what they call heritage breeds. People are probably familiar with heirloom apples and heirloom tomatoes, because the produce industry kind of diversified their product lines much earlier than the meat industry has. But just like there are 100 different breeds of apples, there are 100 different breeds of chickens as well. So even in the broiler industry, but also in the egg industry, there are other breeds of chickens, what you call minor breeds, that tend to be very appealing to small farms because it allows them to differentiate their product in the marketplace.
You all touched on organic feed, but how do you, and I know this is a loaded subject, but what do you do about GMO versus non-GMO feed for your chickens?
That's a great question. That's where we chose to compromise on the organic issue. So our feeds for all our animals, both pork and chicken, have been GMO-free since, I think, 2012. And the other thing really that I think personally is more important is antibiotic use. We've been antibiotic-free from the beginning, and I think that, to me, and I'm just one guy and it's just my opinion, but I think that's a far more important issue than really any of the rest of the things that we've discussed tonight as far as immediate human health implications is that antibiotic use.
Why?
So, because I think that it's very real and very serious. And I think that, the potential for breeding and then releasing resistant bacteria into the environment is very real, and the consequences are obviously catastrophic. So if we had to give up everything, if we had to give that up, I don't think we would produce meat anymore. I think that would probably be a deal breaker for us. Everything else we could probably, try to find middle ground on, but not that.
So by definition, organic feed is non-GMO feed, is that right? So that comes
not
with the territory.
Issue.
Right. Was what Bo was saying earlier about the fish meal, is that part of your ration?
That's not part of the ration that we're using, no.
How do you, do you have to use something else?
They're getting it from, primarily from soybeans.
Okay. And not, just to finish, non-GMO, GMO?
Yeah, I'm the bad guy at the table. We use GMO. And it's not by choice. Again, when we looked into it, we decided that local was more important. So, for example, even though Andrew has this organic production on the Eastern Shore, and Purdue is growing organic grain to supply its producers of their broilers, but it's not like I can go to that mill on the Eastern Shore and say, hey, send me a truckload of GMO-free corn. Because there are a lot of producers like Bo that aren't certified organic but still are GMO-free and choose to without the certification for ideologic reasons, and certainly I believe in that. But I also live in a very small rural community in a poor part of northern Maryland, and it's important for me to keep my money in my local economy. So, for example, there was this one grain grower in Montgomery County who decided to grow GMO-free grain, and I was like, oh, my God, this is great. He had a couple hundred acres, and I went to go talk to him, and I was like, I will buy everything you grow every year. And he turned me down because he needs to make money and survive, and he could make more money processing that feed into bagged chicken feed and selling it to backyard people through Tractor Supply and these other home stores. And I can totally get that because I know how difficult as a small business it is to succeed. And so that was why he was not willing to sell wholesale, because he wanted to sell retail to individuals. So we have GMO grain.
Good.
Could I have two just quick questions. First, a simple egg question. When you hard boil an egg, and one is easy to peel and one is hard to peel, is it the hard one is too old or too fresh?
The old egg is easy to peel. The fresh egg,
the fresh
is very
egg
difficult
does not
to peel.
Okay.
So we tell our customers at the farm stand, if you want to have hard-boiled eggs, leave them in the refrigerator for 3 weeks before you try to hard-boil them. Although I'm sure Spike has got some tricks up.
No, that's sleeve. that's about the story. So I mean, it's sad but true.
Do eggs need to be refrigerated?
Yeah, they should be refrigerated. But just so you know, eggs have a shelf life of about 3 months. So leaving them in the refrigerator for 3 weeks is not going to harm
not,
the okay. quality of the egg.
Okay, so the other question is a little more serious. Is it sounds like both of you guys, this is a lifestyle farm that you live on as opposed to a financial farm. If you had to take what you do and up the scale, could you maintain that? Could you do that? Because we obviously have to feed a lot of people. So if you can blend what everybody does up there between a mass production system and a lower production system that obviously has, you have more flexibility in what you do, but could you upgrade it or can it not be scaled up, basically?
Well, I think you just asked the question that I ask myself about three times a day, and usually those are after, midnight. We're like anybody else, all of us, and we all need scale. We all need to sell volume, despite the premium price that we're all receiving. you got to sell a lot of it. And, you know, for me, I think the decision or you know, the part of the long-term planning is what, how can we scale up and still maintain, like you said, the lifestyle and the thing. And I think we're working on ways to do that. We'll never reach the scale that Andrew's at. And I'm not saying that that's something that I don't want, you know, that there's a problem with where he is. It's just not, we can't, our model would never work at that scale. There's a certain amount of hand labor, and I'm totally envious of his systems and the things that he has at his disposal to control, you know, the things that he can control, because we can't. I can't control those things. But I think there is ground between he and I. You know, I think I can still grow, and we can still keep birds outside, and we can have them eat grass. We can definitely maintain non-GMO. For me, you know, for my part, since we handle the processing, that's another consideration. You know, another thing that I worry about that is typically a huge, huge volume operation and requires huge volumes to be profitable. And we're doing it on, I mean, the micro of micro scale compared to the commercial industry. And so we kind of have to drag along that, not only the processing part, but not only the production part, but the processing part as well. And, you know, I think we have some really unique, really positive things in our processing end that I don't want to lose. And to me, that I think maybe the processing part is probably going to be more of the dictate our scale than what the production side does.
Yeah, I think it also kind of highlights really the problems with our food and farm policy at the federal level when you're talking about the Farm Bill and what we as all taxpayers choose to subsidize and what we value. Whenever I travel, I make it a point to tour farms because I'm just curious about how other people do it. And when I was in Spain a couple of years ago, I toured a pig farm, and they had 13 breeders, which is about what we have. And those 13 breeder pigs supported a family of four, husband and wife, their two children, and their one set of grandparents. So it supported a family of six, those 13 pigs. Now, 13 pigs doesn't sound like a lot, but if they're managed properly, they can generate about 250 piglets a year. But the reason why that farm was financially viable and successful is because of their government programs over there, where they've made a public policy choice to value artisanal food production. And so instead of subsidizing corn and soybean growers, they're subsidizing, you know, hams and prosciutto and things like that. The government regulations also allow a lot of on-farm processing over there where they were slaughtering the pigs on the farm. You know, for every pig that I turn into retail cuts for the farmer's market sales, I have to pay $300 to the butcher. It's really hard to make the numbers work when I do that. And I know why the butcher charges me what he does. He has to make a living, too. He's a small family business. But my point is that our food and farm policy is just upside down in the United States compared. And there are other models out there. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. It's a matter of what, as a society and a culture, we value.
It seems like we often come up against, a lot of times this conversation ends up taking that turn where we just come up against policy, and we're going to try to get somebody in here to talk about that someday, because it's where this conversation a lot of times ends up.
So earlier you said that chickens are omnivores, right? So if you feed them, whether it's corn or soy, as the feed, right? So I'm not sure how it works with rotation or whatnot, but I know if I would have to eat oatmeal every day for like my whole life, I probably wouldn't be able to handle it, even though I had choices later on. So does it have to really come down to per business model that it has to be either corn or soy feed for the chickens?
chickens eat anything that doesn't eat them first. Even sometimes other chickens, snakes. I've seen them eat snakes. And when they go outside, they are happy hunters. And you're glad that they're small, because they do remind you of what a T-Rex would look like, scaled up. I mean, their primary diet, and this is what all of the companies also are going to, is an all-vegetarian diet. So they're getting away from animal protein in the feed. But, you know, they don't seem to mind eating the same thing every day. They don't complain.
How long does it take for your birds to get to maturity, market weight?
About 7 weeks.
And how about for you, Bo?
9 to 10.
And that's what's the difference based on? Is it the feed or is it?
I think it's the energy expended because ours are outside all the time, and the number of steps that they'll take to gain a pound of feed or a calorie of energy or so that energy balance is off. That's number one. Number two is the science and technology that Andrew has in formulating his diets, and the resources that he has are, much greater than what we have at our disposal.
And what are you growing? Just your breed?
We're using a commercial chicken. It came up the heritage breed, and that again isn't necessarily because that's what we want to do. It's because that yields the bird that people want to eat.
Right.
And for us, the first criteria for us to be successful is to grow a product that people want to eat. And we experimented with some heritage breeds, and we did some work with you guys. We gave it the old college try, and at the end of the year, the commercial birds that were raised on pasture were more what people expected. They tasted better, and oh, by the way, they were cheaper.
Right.
So, and we haven't looked back since then.
So. It's probably the same bird, is it, more or less? Or
They are Cornish crosses. I think different companies use different strains.
This is what I grow, the Ross cross, which is a commercial breed. Right. They have been experimenting with some different breeds for the organic birds to try to get birds that are more active, but so far, they haven't been very successful because of health issues with those other breeds, and the fact that they do grow much slower sometimes.
Yeah, uh-huh. We use the Ross 308s as well, and we did a year ago. We did some trials with Hubbard, which is another strain of the Cornish cross, and we found that they did grow slower. But more important to us was the carcass quality was not as good as the Ross that we're growing now. So in 2016, the spring of this year, we switched back to the Ross and haven't gone back.
Got it.
This goes back to the eggs and shelf life and refrigeration. So living overseas, obviously, there was no refrigeration of eggs, and coming back to America, seeing them in refrigeration. Does this come down to the washing of eggs, and what are your policies? Are they regulated by government as far as washing eggs, and how does that determine the shelf life of any particular kind of egg?
Well, that's a good question, because it's really confusing why some people see eggs out on a counter in Europe and yet in the United States are always refrigerated. By law in the U.S., the eggs have to be refrigerated at all times. We have inspectors come to the church parking lot on a Saturday afternoon at the farmer's market, open our coolers, and shine a laser in there to make sure that they're being held at proper temperature. And there's a couple reasons for this. For example, if you take like Holland, that's the size of what, Virginia? And so all the eggs produced in Holland are reaching the grocery stores and the shelves and the restaurants and stuff in a very short time period, because it's a small country. The United States is a very large country with a national distribution, aggregation and distribution system. And so basically you could be getting eggs from 5 different states that are aggregated at a central location and then repackaged and sent out to the grocery store shelves. All of that takes much more time. And so the eggs that reach the shelves in the U.S. are older than the eggs that reach the shelf in Europe. In addition to that, so bottom line is an egg that is not refrigerated is good for 3 to 4 weeks on the countertop. An egg that is refrigerated is good for 3 months. And so the U.S. just made a policy from a health protection standpoint that we're going to refrigerate all eggs, recognizing our distribution channels are much longer. And we do wash our eggs, by the way. You can't raise chickens out in a field and not wash the eggs.
So I just want to, if I can, cross-fertilize the conversation a little bit. So, Andrew, you have this incredible business background and a lot of the economies of scale and the business direction is something that makes sense to you. Is there anything you can relate almost as an advisor to somebody like Bo who would like to go organic but within his parameters that he could do that? Without going necessarily, I'm not saying the Coleman model is bad, I'm just saying for him that's not what he wants to do, but are there features of organic growing that he can get closer to in the kind of business he's in?
I think he's already doing most of the features of organic with you know, the one main thing being that he's not using organic feed, but he is using GMO feed, non-GMO. I myself am happy, and again, as a banker, you know, the main thing I was concerned with was the bottom line. And whatever somebody has to do, there's a lot of different markets out here. I am not worried about our food supply whatsoever. I know how to eat healthy. You walk in the grocery store, you walk around the perimeter of the grocery store. You stay out of the middle aisles. You eat, you know, fresh vegetables, meat, dairy. You're good. I'm not worried about our food supply. I'm very happy with what people want to buy and with farmers that want to supply those needs.
And Bo, if you wanted to expand your scale without going in the direction of a Coleman, what would you do at this point? Other than put more entertainment centers in your chicken chicken yards?
I don't know. I mean, I think, like I mentioned before, I think the we have to decide, and really, it's not just the decision that I make or you know that we make as a family, but the neat thing about our business is that our customers are very much a part of the conversation, and so you know we kind of if we have an idea or if I'm ever doubting what I'm doing is not living up to the ideals that we set for ourselves or that our customers expect from us. The really cool thing is we can have that discussion and say, you know, it's like if I went from 10,000 chickens a year to 50,000 chickens a year, you know, how would you feel about that? I don't know if I'm answering your question, but I think we can keep going in the direction that we're going for a while. And honestly, I think that it'll probably, we could still maintain all of our current practices and grow all the chickens that we want to grow. I think we would not max out, or we would not start crossing lines into territory that we didn't want to go in before we were satisfied with what we had. And so I guess the answer is we just keep broadening what we're doing now.
And how much do you have to educate the chefs and buyers about your product so that they can get the most out of it?
We don't have to do a whole lot. The really cool thing about buyers, both you know, home cooks and professional cooks, is they know a heck of a lot about what's out there and the practices that we're using, and we don't have to do much education. And luckily for me, we don't have to do a whole lot of selling either, because it's not something that I do well. So,
Andrew, I have a question for you. Since you've raised birds, I think just with regular GMO grain and now organic, I have a small backyard flock just for our family, and I've raised regular grain, and now I'm all organic, and I'm noticing the animals are much healthier. I think they finish nicer. They taste better. And I was kind of sold on the organic grain from a grain seller who said that this poultry farmer who had a big barn of chickens noticed a much less morbidity rate when he went to organic. What have you found? That are the animals healthier? Are they finishing better, faster?
Our weight gain and, you know, other factors are about equal with conventional raised broilers. Our livability is better. I'm having the best livability that I've ever had.
Now, what's livability?
Livability is, you know, I get 180,000 chicks in. How many of them do I actually send, you know, send off the farm? And for me as an organic grower, last flock it was about 98%.
Yeah, that's what I've heard when you go to organic.
Now, how much of that is from the grain or from other practices that we're doing, I don't really know.
Now, can the whole barn go outside? Can all 50,000 birds go outside in the field? Or
everybody can go outside. I don't know that they all do go outside. I don't have a little tag on them or anything.
But, uh-huh.
I mean, at any one given point in time, there's usually a couple of thousand birds out there during the day. Most of the time in the morning, they all rush out, and then they'll trade back and forth all day long, and it goes down. And then in the evening, it's like you opened up the floodgates again, and they all want to go back out.
I can tell you that fun. In these 98-degree days, no chicken wants to be outside.
Yeah.
They're all wherever there's shade, that's where they are.
Thank you. Only mad dogs in English.
Yeah.
I have so many questions, but I'm going to try to keep it succinct. Do you use raw feed? Is that who you go to? No, you don't use raw feed.
We mix our own feed on the farm.
Oh, cool. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I just had to know. I use raw feed. They're non-GMO. Great family farm. And Will, I want to know, do you still use the Layer 2000, the big mobile coops that you're moving your chickens through?
Yeah, we kind of have experimented with different scales and found that a colony of 200 works really well because that's the largest size coop we can put on wheels and still have our six-wheeler pull.
Okay.
As we move it around the pasture.
So they're outside every day. They're getting fresh air and sunshine.
Yes.
They're forced to every day. And Bo,
yes.
You as well?
Yes.
They're outside because you're doing mobile coops with all of your birds.
Right.
So that's a difference. And the organic feed, I think, is really important. And your chickens are able to go outside, and I think that's really important. But I feel very strongly that animals, all animals that I want to eat and that I want my children to eat, should have sunshine, natural vitamin D, and fresh air every day. And so I think that's when you said livability is higher, I think part of it is that a lot of those birds get fresh air, and I'm sure the organic standard, you have to have less birds in your coop than with the traditional conventional standard.
That's correct.
So I would guess livability has everything to do with that versus the organic feed.
Oh,
I would attribute it
primarily, I mean, if you were to ask me, and this is just anecdotal evidence, but if you were to ask me why is livability up so much, it's because of the fresh air, I think. Basically, they've told us, you know, because these birds, you got to remember, organic grain costs about 3 times as much as conventional grain. So they want these birds to live. So don't worry about the propane. Run the fans. So we're keeping that air really fresh in there all the time. I mean, one of the things, you know, the chickens in the house, they're never hot, they're never cold. They got, you know, we set the temperature exactly where they want it to be, and we regulate that with running fans or running heat.
And there's your 7 weeks. That's how you get to 7 weeks, and it takes 9 weeks to get the same size of bird because yours are out in conditions of rain and heat and cold, and you're not going to get the same consistency of growing, I would guess. That's probably a big part of it.
I tell people that, so you know, the days of the year when you are making small talk with somebody and you're talking about what a beautiful day it is, you know, what beautiful weather, you know, we're having. Those are good days to have chickens outside. All the rest of the days of the year suck.
Like today.
Okay?
Yeah.
They're terrible. And that's why people move birds inside and give them a climate control environment, because you take all that challenge and all that variability away.
Absolutely.
So you're absolutely right. That's where the challenge comes from.
What do you do with your birds in the wintertime?
We started experimenting with greenhouses. We built a greenhouse last fall, and in fact, we have another one coming next week. We're going to build another one. Historically, we haven't gone to year-round production. Usually, we stop.
Right.
And that's not really a great business model to tell all your customers to go away for 4 months.
Tell me about it.
Come see me
again. Trying to convince people that chickens are seasonal is like... tomato is one thing, but a chicken is clearly not.
And that's another discussion. It seems like it's counter-seasonal. It seems like it's more demand in the winter than in the summer.
Uh-huh.
What we found is we can raise birds in a greenhouse without much, if any, heat. And the combination of the mass of the birds plus the solar gain from the greenhouse provides an environment that they're at least, you know, can survive in and thrive in. And then what we're doing is we're providing, and obviously there's no grass growing in December or, you know, January, so we're providing stored forage in the form of dried hay is what we're using to still maintain a pastured forage-fed animal so that they're still gaining some of those benefits. Any animal, any grass-fed animal in the mid-Atlantic is eating some kind of stored feed through the winter. It's just the nature of the climate that we're in.
How many birds do you get in your greenhouse soon to be?
We're still playing with it. I think 800 to 1,000 per house is kind of the number that we're playing with. It seems to, we have to balance the ventilation issue just like Andrew is.
Uh-huh.
But that seems to be a good number where we still have decent ventilation, but still have enough warmth generated to keep them warm.
Our last question here. Go ahead, Bob.
Oh, so I just wanted to say, it sounds like your chickens are being treated better than the Baltimore County school system children. School's canceled again today, tomorrow, no air condition. Maybe they should take a lesson from chicken farmers on how to cool those buildings. So I hate to do this because we're about to eat, but I have a question about the waste for all three of you. If your animals are outside, what do you do about the waste? Do you leave it out and have it be fertilizer for crops, or do you have to like have somebody or do it yourselves, like collect it and put it in some sort of a shed?
We go around with a little doggy bag.
For 180,000 chickens, right?
No, I mean, they're out on the pasture from week 3 to week 7. So far, it hasn't been an issue. There's been no buildup. I mean, you know, it just goes back in to feed the grass that's there.
Oh, okay.
We manage our poultry manure differently from the other species. The poultry, because they are out year-round, they are spreading their own manure out in the fields, and the regulations don't require you to do anything, you know, about that. And I can tell you, in contrast to some of the other manure that we collect and concentrate and compost before spreading, the difference is when you have a, for lack of a better word, fresh deposition of manure, it's a living thing, and there are all sorts of organisms in the soil that dung beetles, et cetera, and worms and certain bugs that come up, and it disappears really, you know, faster than you would think. And we've seen this with the sheep manure as well that's out in the field. So the problem is when you concentrate large amounts of manure into a pile, the chemistry changes literally because it heats up, it kills a lot of those microorganisms, the pH is altered, and if you mix it with urine too in a lagoon situation like you can with swine manure or dairy manure, it's really putrid. And you know, studies have shown when you apply that mixture onto a field at a later date, literally it repels the microorganisms and the bugs and the beetles in the soil. And so that's the value, I think, of having animals, regardless of species, out on pasture, because you're taking a very natural thing that has that nutrient value, and you're letting it do its benefit. You're getting a benefit out of it, as opposed to turning it into something toxic.
So they don't eat it?
No. They do a lot of gross things, but they don't do that. Now, the dog puppies. Might. But not the chickens.
Ours is very similar to Will's. You know, our birds are pastured, and so they're applying it. You know, they're depositing on green grass, and that takes care of most of it. We do. All of us have to raise young chicks. Have to be kept indoors and in a somewhat controlled environment, just because they're so fragile. And we do that for our birds about the first 2 to 3 weeks of life before they go outside. That is composted. On farm, it's mostly, at that point, is mostly carbon. It's mostly pine shavings is what we use. And so that becomes a key component in, we compost all of the waste from our slaughterhouse. All of our processing waste is composted on the farm. We try to maintain a zero emissions from that plant. So we're using those, that litter as an ingredient in our compost. So that's the only thing that's not deposited directly on the ground and left there.
Thank you. I'm curious about profitability. Are your operations profitable? And are any of you willing to discuss what your margins are?
Well, I'm probably the smallest guy at the table here, so I'll speak first. And that way you'll be left with a more positive message from the speaker. You know, that's just an incredibly difficult question to answer. So just to give you a sense of scale, we're 30 acres. We have 4 employees. Our gross revenue is $330,000 a year. My husband works full-time off the farm, and he pays the mortgage. The farm business could not buy the land, although the farm business does pay for all the employees, including health care, paid vacation, you know, the whole nine yards. It's just the reality of farming these days. If you look at the statistics, 90% of farmers have one spouse that works full-time off the farm to give you that financial stability, because your farm income is literally like this. So, for example, we got a freak virus that came out of nowhere and took out 50% of our piglet crop in the spring of this year. And so that was a huge hit. And, you know, I had to call Spike up and say, hey, sorry, I don't have any pigs for you after September, you know, because our production system is 6 months in advance. And so it's really difficult to absorb those types of financial hits.
I don't know. I'm not a big number cruncher. You know? And it's not that I wouldn't share those numbers. I know people that know those numbers. They can tell you what they made yesterday. Yeah. I'm not that guy. I'm lucky if I can come up with a year ago, you know. I go by the things that we're able to do. And so, similar to Will, my wife has a full-time job. She's self-employed and works off the farm as well as on the farm. But I think that what I've been able to do through the farm is to at least meter in the middle, you know. So I've been able to provide an income that any other married couple or any other couple would be able to do, you know, kind of share the load. Our farm does, you know, we're making 2 mortgage payments from the farm. The farm is supporting that. We have my full-time income plus we also have 4 employees. I don't know if we treat them as well as Whitmore does, but nobody tell them that, please. But yeah, so, and for me, when I look at those things and we're able to do those things and feel confident that we can continue to do them, you know, 6 months or a year from now, then I feel like, yeah, the answer to the profitability question is yes, we are. This guy knows what he made yesterday.
Yeah, that's what I spend my time in there doing, is thinking about money. No, I do. And yes, it is profitable. And I wouldn't do it if it wasn't.
So, wow, there's plenty more to talk about, and the conversation here, if you're with us in the room, is going to continue over dinner. you won't have to answer Dana's question quite yet, because we have chicken and egg for a beautiful supper, roasted chicken, eggs in purgatory, one of our favorite dishes, some beautiful eggs. You know, I don't know where the eggs are from tonight. Are they? Yeah. Terrible. I know. But eggs simmered in a delicious tomato sauce. Opie's out there, and he's got dinner ready. And then I'm going to whip up a sabayon, an egg with some fresh fruit for dessert. But I just want to first and foremost thank these panelists. I think it's crucial for everybody in this room and for everybody that cares about their food to be able to have the choices that these guys are providing. And I'm so grateful for you guys for doing what you do and also making the effort to come and talk about it. It helps folks like us who do care about where our food comes from, how it's grown, understand more about it, and I think ultimately make better, more informed choices. So thank you so much for being here. And thank all of you who are in this room and all of you who are maybe listening online for caring about where your food comes from.
Just one last comment for those of you that are new tonight, and there are several new faces. If you are wondering about the microphones, I forgot to say at the beginning that the whole conversation is being recorded and will be edited and uploaded to Heritage Public Radio. It's an online, all food and drink, anything you ever wanted to know about food, the restaurant business, anything connected to agriculture. It's based in Brooklyn, New York. It's www.heritageradionetwork.org. So if you just put in search for Origins, you'll hear all 12 episodes. And I also just wanted to thank, we have a new recording engineer tonight, Donnie, who's sitting out here. Donnie came to us from WTMD, another great local radio station. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Donnie. So that's it. Enjoy.
Thanks again for joining us tonight for our conversation at Artifact Coffee. With special thanks to Dana Slater for producing the program, Hannah Reagan for her masterful coordination, and particular thanks to Donnie Carlo for recording this evening's conversation. We're grateful to be partnering with Heritage Radio in Brooklyn, New York. Thank you to them for creating a home for the Origin Speaker Series.